Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart.
Welcome. You're listening to Art on the Air on WVLP 103.1 FM and Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM, our weekly program covering arts and arts events throughout Northwest Indiana and beyond. I'm Larry Breckner of New Perspectives Photography, right alongside here with Esther Golden of The Nest in Michigan City.
Aloha, everyone.
We're your hosts for Art on the Air. Our theme music is by Billy Foster, with a vocal by Renee Foster. Our underwriters for Art in the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum, regional art patron Mary Levan, and our landlord, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments. Thank you for your generous support. Art on the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project grant through South Shore Arts and the National Endowment for the Arts. Thanks to Greg Kovach, WVLP's station manager, and Tom Maloney, vice president of radio operations at Lakeshore Public Radio. Art on the Air streams live at WVLP.org and is rebroadcast on Monday at 5 p.m., plus is also heard on Lakeshore Public Radio, 89.1 FM, every Sunday at 7 p.m., also streaming live at lakeshorepublicradio.org, and is available on Lakeshore Public Radio's website as a podcast. Our spotlight interviews are also heard Wednesdays on Lakeshore Public Radio. Information about Art on the Air is available at our website, breck.com/AOTA. That's breck, BRECH.com/AOTA. That includes a complete show archive, spotlight interviews, plus our show is available on multiple podcast platforms, including NPR One. Please like us on Facebook, Art on the Air, WVLP, for information about upcoming shows and interviews. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts-related event, exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck, BRECH.com, or through our Facebook page. And Art on the Air Spotlight, we'd welcome back to here from the Tomfoolery Fun Club, which they do lots of things. It's a variety show consisting of various forms of comedy, complemented by entertainment. Tom Bielek and Michelle Pisco, otherwise known as Miss Michelle, welcome back to Art on the Air Spotlight.
Thanks, Larry. Thanks, Esther. Thanks for having us.
Nice to see you.
We're excited to be here.
Well, we want you to briefly tell us a little about the Tomfoolery Fun Club, what it does and what you do, and then what you're not being able to do because of the pandemic, and then we'll move on to your new venture in podcasting.
Okay. Well, the Tomfoolery Fun Club is a comedy-based variety show. Our shows feature what we feel is some of the finest stand-up, improv, sketch, musical, and magical comedy available.
Yes, and we also have live bands in every show, and the genre of music ranges from rock, blues, jazz, alternative, 80s music. We love it all.
And we've been staging shows for almost 7 years, and we're up to almost 100 shows. We kind of lost count, but about 100 shows or so over the last 7 years, ranging anywhere from 50 to 60 people in the audience up to about 500.
And the last one was in Michigan City, right? The last show before this?
Right. Yes, we were at the Oryx Shrine facility in Michigan City. That was on Leap Day, February 29th, and that was our last event that we conducted, rather.
What are some of the venues you've played at?
Yes, we've been at our home base of Rodney's Langle's Pizza. That's where we started the show, and we've had many, many shows there. Also, we've been at, like we said, Oryx Shrine, also Villa Cesare.
Hoosier Theater in Whiting, we've done some events there. Roxy Theater is a nice venue in Lockport, Illinois, that we started staging events about a year and a half ago. So we're kind of like the circus, you know, we travel around a little bit, we pack up our stuff and go, and we're never quite sure where we're going to land next.
How are you regrouping? Because I remember you saying after the Michigan City show, that was kind of a pinnacle event, that it was just came all together for you. So what's in your future?
Well, first of all, it really did. We felt like we had it. We always felt like we had it figured out, but we were just waiting for the audience to catch on. And after that show, it just seemed like everything really gelled, and we had great comedy and music, but just great audience participation. And then, as we say, and then COVID hit, we had to put everything on hold. And Michelle and I just made the decision to really put everything on hold until we know it's safe for everyone. Although some production companies have pressed on and done shows with social distancing and mask wearing and disinfectants and things like that. We like to get around to the audience and meet everybody and greet and talk and get to know people. So we just decided that if we can't do it the way we really want and stay true to our brand, that we just decided to put everything on hold and just wait.
So you have a new thing that you're doing in podcasting called Straight Out of Tomfoolery. So tell us, one of you, what about that?
Sure. Well, we started the audio version of that a while back. We'd have to really go back to see exactly when we started it. And it was just the audio. And then we decided, since we kind of miss being around larger groups of people and around people in general. So we thought, well, we could still do this, but let's do it with a video twist to it. So we are doing it with a bit more consistency now with the video twist. So we're videotaping it and we're still pushing it out to our audience. We still have, a following on Facebook, Instagram, and different social media platforms. So we thought, well, let's still stay connected that way, even though we can't literally be in front of you in the physical sense.
Where can they find you guys for that? Or where can you, and how often do you do it?
Well, we've been doing pretty consistently on Sunday mornings, and then we release the video blog on Sunday afternoon. But you can find us on our Facebook page, Tomfoolery Fun Club, or we also have a YouTube channel, Tomfoolery Fun Club, or either of our personal Facebook pages. We share it on there. We enjoy it. We miss the attention. We kind of like to be out in front of people. We don't pretend to be entertainers, but we just like to be out there.
Entertaining.
And we love to get comments from people. We get emails. We send it out on a mass email also. And people will send back suggestions or like most recently, we put together a new studio and we were looking for a name. And then some we asked people, just what would you name it? So they gave us a few suggestions and some were pretty good. And others not so much, but it's still fun just the same.
Give us those websites and everything again once, so we make sure they get that for your place.
Sure. Our Facebook page is Tomfoolery Fun Club. Also, it would be Tom Bylick or Michelle Gonzalez Piskel for the Facebook pages that are our personal pages. And also Instagram is Tomfoolery Fun Club. And our website is under reconstruction. We're going to just kind of revamp it a little bit, coming back fresh after COVID. So, but that is tomfooleryfunclub.com.
Excellent.
That's tomfooleryfunclub.com.
Very good. Well, thank you so much for being on Art in the Air Spotlight. Tom Bylick, Michelle Piskel, the purveyors of the great Tomfoolery Fun Club. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Larry. Thank you, Esther.
Thanks, Larry and Esther.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. And our next guest on Art on the Air is a longtime dom of the artistic world here in Northwest Indiana. Been around for a little bit of while and has been well known for all her work throughout here. She's just closed an exhibit at South Shore Arts in the main Bachman Gallery, a whole retrospective of her career and everything like that. She's been an art educator, and she's graciously agreed to come on Art on the Air. Please welcome Barbara Meeker to Art on the Air.
Hello. Aloha, Barbara.
Well, Barbara, a lot of the people in our audience, that if anyone knows anything about Northwest Indian art, they probably know you. But there's some of our listeners that may not know much about you. So tell us a little bit about your background, where you grew up, where you studied and everything, and how you got into art and everything. So tell us your journey from where you were to where you are now.
Okay. I was born in Peru, Indiana, and my mother and dad dad's father and family, the Miller family. I was originally Barbara Miller. Had been there for a good many years. And it's a small town. Cole Porter also came from Peru. And it was a nice small town atmosphere. My mother loved art. She came from a family. Her dad and her brother were both engineers and creative people in many ways. My uncle especially got into all kinds of forms of the art. Both of them had patents on machinery and on various other things. So the creativity came through with my mother also in many ways. So she immediately, as a small child, started encouraging me to do creative things just because she was like my model for that.
So what kind of things did she encourage? I was interested in knowing
well,
that.
Well, she made things available for me to play with that were creative. She was quite a gardener, and so have I been all these years. And she would go out and pick a bunch of things that were just odds and ends, bushes and a few flowers and things, and put it on the table and make it just beautiful. And with, you know, she can have a big garden. And she also was musical, and my dad and his three brothers were the Miller Brothers Quartet. So music was very important. Yeah, they sang and performed in a little opera house in Peru for a good many years. And he was a tenor. I sang in the church choir at the Methodist Church, which my grandparents before me had been very active in. And so we were. And so singing and music, and I know sometimes my uncle, one brother that was the bass, he and my dad would babysit me when my mother was out for some reason, and they'd sing together and to amuse me, because in a small town, you know, there wasn't a whole lot going on besides your home.
So was this the uncle that did the woodworking? Did he teach you any of those skills?
No, that was my dad's brother. My mother had the brother, Uncle Ralph Burton. Her maiden name was Burton. And he was so creative, and he lived close by. So he also was over at the house doing creative things of all sorts of things. And he ended up designing machinery for the first round ice cream container for Dean's, I think it was, and years ago. And he built it in an old garage in a machinery there in Indiana, in Peru, Indiana. And then he made miniature furniture, which I have quite a collection of, that is just unbelievably good. And he worked up in a little attic of the house where he lived, and did things on the lathe that you would never believe. And he was always making us gifts. And one of his greatest gifts was a dollhouse he made for me that I still have in the basement. And my great-grandchildren are now enjoying it when they come to visit. And he made other little cabinets for me, and just all kinds of creative things. And he was also had one wonderful sense of humor, so I got to enjoy both those uncles.
Gosh, what a blessing to be surrounded by so much creativity. It was predestined, yes. I think, that you would become an artist.
Exactly. And it was that art and music was very important. So I started drawing as soon as my mother would take me down to Indianapolis once in a while to a place called Lyman's, where they sold art materials. And I remember it was on the second or third floor. We had to take an elevator, and it was so exciting. She let me pick out art supplies. And so I had materials. I don't remember where we got the paper and that sort of thing, but she would sit and work with me. And as I got older, and in school, then I started drawing people and drawing things, and she was always encouraging me. I had a terrible elementary school art teacher who would bring in a picture and stick it on the board in front and say, "Now we all copy this." And of course, that was just forbidden as far as I was concerned, and I went along with it. But pretty soon, when I got into some better teachers, then the real creativity came out in high school. And I had a great art teacher who had been in the service and had done silk screening and things on the trucks and the military vehicles. And so he just taught me so much and helped me create doing silk screening, which is a complicated process, but I learned that. And just more drawing. And then I ended up at DePauw University, because my father said, "That's where you're going to school." He had gone there, some of his family had, and he thought it was a great school. My mother wanted me to go to John Heron in Indianapolis, which was an art school. And I said, "No, I think I'd rather go to DePauw." And I had one of the best teaching and drawing instructors that ever lived, I think. And he was even saying to us in class, Reed Lindsay was his name. And he drove this little red sports car around the campus, which was small. It was a very small Methodist school in, just outside of Indianapolis. But he probably gave me the biggest boost. And the one portrait that I had in my exhibition, which is actually still going, they've extended it and are hanging it in the back room behind the gallery and also in the atrium because of popular demand, according to what they wrote in the website.
Oh, so, how wonderful.
Because of the money that's retrieved from the art goes to 60% of it to the Art Center and 40% to hospice in Munster. So anyway, as I got into college and started finding my way, I decided I wanted to teach and didn't really do that until my junior year, so I had to cram it all in. And then decided I was going to get married to Bill Meeker, whose father and grandfather were dentists in Peru, and we'd all gone to the same church. And so I knew him, but he was a little older and had gotten double promoted, so he was an extra year ahead of me. And we moved up here to Hammond. I got my first teaching job in the Hammond Public Schools in 1952. And I had a secondary license because of the fact I didn't decide I wanted to teach till my junior year, and you have to kind of cram a lot of things in. So Superintendent Mr. Crandall, I think his name, he said, well, that's no problem. He said, you can teach elementary. And I started out at Maywood, Wallace, and the Riverside in Hammond. Eventually taught at Kenwood and Edison. And let's see, I think that's all of them. So I was a traveling art teacher for 7 years, I think, in Hammond until I had my first child, my first son. And really enjoyed that. I got to know Olga Schubkegel, who was our head of the art department. And we had probably a staff of 14 or 15 in all the schools. And she was a tyrant, but she was nationally known as an art educator. And it was an experience to work for her, which I did for 6 or 7 years until I had to retire because I was expecting my baby and they didn't want pregnant people around. So anyway, I learned so much living in Hammond and getting to know all the art teachers and got beginning to get involved in the Northern Indiana Arts Association because that was my desire, was to be involved in the arts. And so therefore I was involved in the first building that they ever had, at the old Christian Science Church on Holman Avenue. And they purchased that, as I remember, didn't know all the details, but that became our first home in the early 60s, I think it was. And I started at Purdue in 64 for 21 years. And so I had to back off after a while because I was in there telling them they needed art classes. So we got people to teach and I taught for a while. But I couldn't do both, so I backed away from that. But that's where I got involved with that art association that was really very big in this area at that time. And I later was on the board here in Munster in the 90s. And we had our art association, art group involved in this new building, which... Bill Bachman's father, Bill Bachman, was the architect for all that. So, and I knew him because I was teaching in the Department of Architectural and designed the course that Chuck Hutton, who was the son of one of the prominent architects in Hammond, designed. He hired me and he said, I want you to design a course to teach these 18-year-old kids, which they had to take if they were in architectural technology or in civil engineering technology. It was required the first semester. And then we added a second semester, and I taught them color. And they basically learned to draw and then eventually did drawings of buildings, not architectural, you know, the real strict drawings, but something that was could be used as a rendering to advertise the homes and that sort of thing. So I ended up having them do them finished things, not only in black and white, but the second semester in color. So, and it was all based upon my learning from Reed Winsey, because he didn't have a booklet. I finally made a little, like a small textbook, and Chuck suggested that I use the students' drawings as illustrations along with mine, which made it easier for me, and I didn't have to draw so much on the board, because these kids, I would say 80% of them had never had an art class. And here they were in a department of all male instructors and professors, and here was a woman in the department, and they probably thought it was going to be a, you know, just an easy fluff course.
Right.
And Chuck was, he wanted them, he said, you take them outside and let them see, you know, look at things and draw, which we did. Had some interesting experiences different times. One time in a neighborhood, some lady called the police. She didn't know what we were doing out there with all these kids around. So that was in over in the Purdue area in the 60s and 70s. So it was really a wonderful challenge. I didn't know that I could handle being with all PhDs and engineering experts in the fields, you know, because it was, there were only a very few women on the faculty, and some, the most of them were in the nursing department. And, but I adjusted to that pretty fast, because everybody was kind of, I was kind of unique, we will say.
Well, and a lot of that can be bridged when you're also not only unique, but competent. So
yeah, that helped, of course. And I had taught here at home when we moved into this house in 1956. I started art classes as soon as I got adjusted with my first baby. And my husband was the next person who really urged me to be active in whatever I was interested in. So we started art classes, and nobody did anything like that back then. And it became so popular, I had a waiting list, and then I ended up, I had a class for the younger children, say, you know, 5, 6 and up to the grade schools. And then I had an older class for the older kids. And then I ended up having an adult class in the evening once in a while. And I did that all until the late 60s. And then it got to be way too much for me.
Because I was going to say, when do you have time for your own art practice with all of that?
Well, there wasn't a whole lot left, and I really enjoyed it, but I had to cut back so that I wasn't overtired, you know, but I enjoyed it. And the majority of those kids that I had here ended up doing something in the arts. In fact, the Denmark children, Mr. Denmark owned a, I don't know if it was a Rothschild store, but it's a clothing store in downtown Hammond, and he had 4 girls. And they all took classes, Marcy and Tracy. Tracy is still Tracy Schwimmer, and they even give a scholarship, or not scholarship, but prize money now at the Salon Show, which is going to be opening in a week or so. And Marcy also was into art. And then their third sister had leukemia, and she was only 11 and passed away. And but those children are an example. Also, I see the mother of a young lady, I don't remember their last name, and the father was a doctor in East Chicago. And she, I know, went on, was very active. I've lost track of some of them. But I've also had students that I had at Purdue. I keep in touch with a young man who's an architect in Phoenix and has done very well. And in fact, he's come to see me and came back one time when I was still at the Steeple Gallery and went to see all my work. And I just found a drawing of him, because when I taught them figure drawing and they posed, they had to take turns posing because we didn't have models. So I found a drawing, and when the kids would draw, I drew and did sketches. So I have several sketchbooks full of students in my classes that I think are going to give to the archives at Purdue. And I found one with this young man, Ken Summers, name on it. So I took a picture of it and sent it. And he said, would you send it to me? I said, sure. Oh. And so, you know, it was an interesting situation for me as a challenge, but I wasn't afraid of it. And I really enjoyed working with all the professors. In fact, I ended up with another class I designed called Applied Imagination, because there was a professor in a nearby department who was teaching creative thinking. And he and I got so we would trade classes, and he would teach mine and I would teach his once in a while. And also some of the professors in the other engineering departments asked me to come and do a, they said, could you come and give a one-day drawing lesson? And I said, well, that's to be pretty abbreviated. But in one case, they used microscopes. And he said, I understand that you've taught the students to look at something and draw while looking at the object. And I said, yes, I even showed them a film about it. And it's really loosens up. And I said, I told the students, what you're learning is not how to be an artist. You're learning how to see, because everybody misses so much because they really aren't looking and seeing what they're looking at. And so I ended up doing things like that. And I had a young woman who was in the nursing program, and she came in and said, I never dreamed I could look in the microscope and draw at the same time. And I said, well, why not? You know, so, and, you know, I ended up inspiring others. Plus, my boss let me start some painting classes, which there was no art department when I was hired. And Chuck Hutton was extremely creative in many ways. And so we started a painting class, but I taught acrylics because by then they were out and so much better than the oils. And so I taught evening classes in the continuing education department. I started those. And as I said, I designed that other course about applied imagination. And so it got people over there interested because it was something totally different from all the engineering and technology. And of course, I was in the school of technology. So anyway, I taught there until 1986. And one of my favorite students is David McLeese, who is still there being like the computer guru at the university. He was 18 in 1980, and he came to my class, and they said, I have to teach him how to draw. He was in a wheelchair, and at the time he was a paraplegic and had little use of his hands. And that was a real challenge. And after I had him there a while, that was about 1980 when they had just PCs. And one of my deans said to me, oh, well, you can teach him, you know, with PC paint. And I said, oh, forget it. That's so limited. No, we can't do that. Well, then manufacturing engineering had been donated this huge computer, which was on the first floor of the Anderson building. And he said, how about trying that? And luckily, David went to Highland High School and he got a lot of training on computers. And so he had some background in it. And I said, well, you figure out how to use this great big thing. It was huge, and it had a great big inkjet printer. But you could draw on it and make things, use dot to dot. It was some of the first upscales, right. I think. And that worked for him. And so he and I sat at the computer, and I said, you figure out all the computer moves, and I'll tell you what you need to do to draw a building. And we did it. And then Chuck Hutton had a dream of getting a department of graphic arts, or, you know, back then they called it another word, which I can't think of right now. But anyway, I heard that the University of Northern Illinois was going to have a workshop in graphic arts. And I knew his mother because she worked at the police station here in Munster, and my husband knew her. And so I said, okay, you've got to take David over there for this week workshop, because that could be his life. And that's what, you know, we could really get him going and doing something that will make him a living and everything. So that's what she did. And when he came back, boy, the professor said, can you do this? Can you do that? And he got all kinds of extra jobs because I kept telling him, I know somebody that can do that. And at the time, we had one or two people that were computer gurus, type. One of them was in down the hall from me, and he had dived into a swimming pool when he got married and broke his neck. And so he was in a wheelchair. So people like that gradually faded away. And David's been there now since he started school in 1980. And he has his own office. And he doesn't teach, but he's there. He solves the problems. I'd say he's a problem solver. And I'm so proud of him. And he came over to see my exhibit with our former secretary, Laura, who's still there. And so he spread the word around over there. So some of the staff, most of them are retired that were there when I was there. But it was great to see him and to see my show. And then I took him around and talked about a lot of it. And he was telling me, I still remember things that you told us. And he said, the one I remember the most is you said, David, do your own thing. You don't have to do what the person next to you or across from you is doing. Do your own thing. And I said, David, I told that to the elementary children when I'd go in and I had 30 minutes to teach them an art lesson. And I would say, having had a terrible art teacher in grade school, I say, now this is just for you to create something that's yours. Don't look at your neighbor on either side or across the aisle. Do your thing.
That's like the highest honor to have your students say that to you.
Yes, it was. And
it's such an illustrious career that you've had, but that's like a pinnacle moment.
Yes, well, and teaching has always been my first love. I never intended to try to make myself famous. I did enter a lot of national shows. I won awards in some of them, and that's back when you had to do a slide and send it in.
Yes.
And there'd be thousands, and it was difficult, but I knew I had studied with people all over the country for, I don't know how many years. I took workshops from coast to coast and went to Spain once with Miles Batt and Don Kingman. Those were two of my favorites, but I studied with a lot of other very creative people too. And I would come home with a body of work. And at that time I was with the Trachtenberg Gallery. And she sold a lot. I'd have a show about every 2 years. And the industrial studies that I did, I started doing early on.
Well, Barb, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. That's Barbara Meeker, a longtime artist in Northwest Indiana, educator. You can still catch her work at South Shore Arts on Ridge Road there in Munster. They're in some of the auxiliary galleries and everything. You can also go online to her website,
barbaramemeeker.com,
and see her work. And actually, on the South Shore Arts website, you can also see a retrospective work. And she's coming up on Eye in the Arts sometime later in November or early December. Barbara, thank you for coming on Art on the Air. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Larry and Esther.
Thank you, Barbara. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Art on the Air, WVLP 103.1 FM, and on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. And we'd like to welcome to Art in the Air the DK Devils. They preserve history in the forefront of adventures of community outreach. They look for rehabilitation of projects in Northwest Indiana. They play an active role in restoring abandoned buildings and doing many things. With us is the president, Tyrell Anderson, and vice president of DK Devils, Lori Gonzalez. Welcome to Art on the Air.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Aloha. Hello.
Well, my first question is, we want to hear maybe a little bit about your personal journey. So we'll start with you, Tyrell. Tell us a little bit about your background, how you got from where you grew up, where you went to school, how you got from where you were to where you are now.
So Gary is home, born and raised, graduated from Westside High in 2003, went down to Purdue Lafayette, majored in civil engineering, found out I wasn't right for that field, switched over to industrial technology, finished there, worked for Edie's for Nestle for a few years, and ended up back here in Gary working for U.S. Steel 2 years later. Somehow ended up back at home. That wasn't the plan, but that's how it ended up working out for me.
Go ahead. Tell us a little bit about your background, Lori.
I also was born and raised in Gary. I kind of moved out of Gary once my kids got to school age, and then we lived in different places. I went to Lewallis High School, graduated, went to IUN, then moved away, then finished up at IUPUI and graduated with a liberal arts degree, majored in sociology, minored in psychology. I've had all types of jobs. Right now I work at Ford Motor Company, and then, you know, we do Decay Devils.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the Decay Devils as we move off of that. What was the inspiration for it? I assume you both were founding members?
Yes. Our organization, we were based off of our love for photography and just being creative individuals. So I started out doing film. I met Lori doing a couple film projects. Once I met a few other people, Mickey, she's one of our founders. We started going to more abandoned places and just taking pictures and being fascinated by the structures. And I remember giving Lori a random call saying, hey, we're going to a school. You should come with us.
Actually, wait. You were like, do you want to go explore? And I'm like, explore what? Sure. Why not? You know, and that's how I kind of jumped in. I didn't even have a camera at that time. And then I was just like, without a camera, and I couldn't capture anything, which sucked. But just being able to go in those buildings and see like this leftover life was amazing to me. And then that drew me in. And then I ended up getting a camera not too long after that.
So that was around 2012, 2013. We were just taking pictures. And as more people gravitated towards us, we became official, non-official. We were just traveling the states, you know, whatever we can do in a quick road trip.
Yeah.
In 2015, the name kind of gravitated towards us and we stuck with the name.
So yeah, we actually got jackets and had patches made and that said our name before we actually became official.
No, that was 2013.
Yeah.
And then 2015, Andrea, she's another founder, she suggested, hey, we should do something more. We should try to, because we were already doing community cleanups and stuff like that. And she suggested that we should try to do our own initiative as a nonprofit. So that's when we did the 501. She did the 501c3 paperwork and pushed that through, and we became an official nonprofit from there.
So what was your first project? Because I love how you phrase it. You know, you came together for the love of art and adventure, and those two really pair well together. So was the art part only photography at first? Or because as you go through Gary, it's like filled with beautiful murals. And so is that part of?
No, a lot of that stemmed from different projects, but our initial focus was just the photography. So when we got started and no one really wanted to work with a Decay Devil because it has devil in it.
Our name.
And we all have tattoos and a lot of people were just, you know, not sure of our direction. A lot of our initial fundraisers were based around us selling our art, our photography from not just Gary, but our travels across the U.S.,
I don't think we fit the profile. We kind of wore like hoodies that said I play in abandoned buildings, like black hoodies. And I just think that maybe we didn't look approachable. And I don't think people realized, hey, we're all adults with degrees and we're intelligent. You know, they just looked at us like, oh, they're kind of edgy. We don't know what they're about.
So, yeah, a lot of our initial efforts to raise funds were based around our art. We would sell our art. We would do whatever until we started receiving grant funding. You know, we were doing those type of things based around our art to fuel our projects. But the Union Station was not our first project attempt, I guess I should say. Yeah. We tried to do some work with the Gary Public Schools. We wanted to actually do Lewallis Horseman. It was Lewallis and Horseman for sure. Yeah. We wanted to, since we knew how to get into the buildings, we had a pitch where, hey, we could help you guys board up and secure your schools free of charge.
And take out everything of value that another school could use, because a lot of those schools left a lot of things that other schools could use.
Of brand new books, a lot of brand new tables, you name it.
Anything like that, we were like, well, we can repurpose that.
That was shot down for a year consistently until we were able to do our Union Station project.
So are you responsible? Because I know in Gary, especially because people were going into, and not always safely, into a lot of the abandoned places, that they came up with a program with a fee, that you could pay a fee and go in to photograph. Were the Decay Devils part of that?
We were not a part of that. We, our main goal was to just help preserve what was there, because when we were going to the buildings, there were still trophies from the 50s and 60s. There were still band uniforms. There were high school graduation photos from the 20s.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
Almost from the 20s. So, like, those are the things that we wanted to help preserve, because
even artwork.
Yeah, even artworks. Because our vision was, it might not be on the table now, but in the future, and if a museum does pop up, there are so many things that are sitting in these vacant spaces that can be put on display that we see when we travel, you know, to various cities, and we wanted to be able to just preserve that information.
So where are they archived now? What were you able to? They're not?
We did not get the opportunity.
Yeah, they didn't give us permission.
And so that was the
thing. You still so valuable. It's hard to understand.
And that's the part that was kind of frustrating for us, because once we did the switch over to the nonprofit, a lot of the risk taking that we were doing, we had to stop, because you didn't want to put any bad name on the nonprofit or the city. That's the last thing I want to see is Decayed Devils caught doing blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. And stealing. But then they gave the stuff that they stole away to another school. It just would have been kind of bad, like a bad rep for us, even if we were trying to do good.
Right.
But we try to get permission to do things now.
What were some of the buildings you started with, like in Gary, before you went out nationwide?
Well, we all came under the umbrella mainly because of City Methodist. Yeah. That was what brought us all together. Mm-hmm. Even when we would go out to, you know, venture to other places, we would all meet at City Methodist first.
It's our home base.
It's like our home. You see so many creative people there from all walks of life, from all parts of the country, just walking the streets there to take pictures. City Methodist Horseman was a big one. The schools were definitely big, mainly for me, because a lot of the schools I've never set foot in. My first time ever seeing Lew Wallace, it was closed. And that
I
was
thought you played sports.
I ran track. That's what I'm sad.
I'm like, I was in all of them because I played volleyball. So, like, we had to go to all of them. So, I remember the gyms a lot.
So, yeah, when Lew Wallace closed and they were getting ready to prep for the auction, that was my first time ever setting foot in the school. And I remember telling Lori, like, this school is in perfect condition. There was nothing.
Yeah.
Nothing visibly wrong with the school. And it's just unfortunate that, I mean, we understand why things are the way they are, but it's like, man, you hate to see something that's in really great condition, you know, just kind of
not be repurposed for, right. And there's such a great need. There's such a great need for space to be repurposed in compassionate ways.
So tell us, like, if someone was interested in, first of all, just going to these buildings to photograph things. I'm a photographer myself. What's the procedure? Do you just go, or do you want to check in with the city or something like that?
Well, people do. You can get permits. That's not how we started.
Right.
I mean, honestly, the first time when I first moved back to Gary, I was doing film. I just finished like my first short film in Fort Wayne, and I moved back here. I was doing videos, and I remember calling my family saying, hey, it's this real cool church. I need security. I need all you guys to come up here, and, you know, and we got every blunt object that we could, and we went into City Methodist, and it was a culture shock for me, because number one, the day we went in, the church was full. There was someone on a band practicing their drums. There was someone in like a foyer area. They were modeling dresses, a full-blown photo shoot in the cathedral. There was a band doing the photo shoot for their album cover. I was just kind of taken back, like, it's people in here who want to create just like me. So that just piqued my interest and changed my mind big time. Being creative, so I want to take pictures. I want to do this. It went from being creative to what's the history behind these buildings. And it just continue to, you know, build and build and build momentum. Yeah, that was how my base started. Just I want to go and check a spot and see if it's good enough to film to where we are today. It's wild.
Just real out of curiosity, since I'm a photographer, but we do have photographers that listen to the show, what kind of equipment do you use when you go in there?
I only shoot with Sony. I shoot with Sony everything.
He influenced me, so we're just team Sony over
okay.
here.
Okay.
My leaning towards Sony was what my original filming equipment was.
Right.
And so when I switched over to, I was like, well, filming is hard to raise money, but I can take pictures and, get some of my money for my film projects. For me, it was like, well, I'll just keep everything compatible with the same company. I actually stopped filming. So because it turns out I'm a better photographer than filmmaker.
Oh, that's good.
I bought one professional camera. When I got it, it was already obsolete. From there, I decided to film everything with my cameras, and the interchangeable lenses makes life very beautiful when you are a creative person. But what turned me off from filming is editing. I have no bone in my body that wants to sit down and edit film. I can edit pictures all day, but film is a whole nother nightmare for me.
It's a tough thing. Yeah, I know. So we talked about projects in Gary. Where else have you gone in the country to do this type of thing with the Decay Devils?
We started out just doing 4-hour road trips. So our first pit stop was Detroit.
In 2012, December of 2012, I'd like to add, because it was so cold and it was snowing.
And everyone kept equating Detroit to, hey, it's just a bit Gary.
Oh, God. And then there's so many bad things that they said about it.
And once we got to Detroit, it was like, this place is awesome. People are nice. You can see the development of the city. You can see a lot of the vacant buildings starting to come down. And we didn't have anything bad to say about Detroit when we left, other than, like, it was cold.
Even the homeless people spoke. Everybody, and said, hey, how you doing?
Everybody
it was not bad at all.
You can tell we were from out of town. Everyone treated us as though we were family. And that was, I can never say anything bad. We go to Detroit probably once a year, minus this year because of Corona.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's always been very loving people to us, And so from there, it was like, cool, what's next? And
then
we did Cleveland. We drove down to Kentucky. New Orleans. We went through Kentucky.
So tell us, when you come into a city, what is it that you are doing and looking for?
Well, we research first to see what is there. What historical buildings that may have been neglected. We want to see those buildings. And so when you go into a city, we initially already have a plan of some sort. To see, where these buildings are and what condition they're in.
And as we grown, I want to say Kentucky changed me for sure, because we went to go eat at, we needed Wi-Fi. This is before internets where we had good service on your phone. And we went to go to McDonald's to use their Wi-Fi, and their drive-thru was, the inside was closed for remodeling, and only the drive-thru was open. So we ate at this hole-in-the-wall breakfast spot, and it was absolutely amazing. Probably one of the best breakfasts I ever had, and top three of everywhere I've ever eaten. And so what we started to do from there was like, okay, cool. What are some good eateries? What are some good museums? What are the things that the locals do? Let's immerse ourselves in the culture. So we began to shift, as the years went on. We used to just go to abandoned buildings and go back to the hotel.
I didn't even pack anything nice. It was just like, pack some old shoes, old clothes, because we're going to get dirty. And then when we did the transition, we actually experienced, whatever place we were at.
And that kind of changes your viewpoint of the entire landscape, because you see everything from their past, their present, and their future. You get to experience that city as a whole. You get to learn about those individuals as a whole. And it allows you to respect their landscape a lot more. So I'm glad that we had those opportunities to just really go and immerse ourselves in. This is where the locals go shop. We go buy. We went to Seattle. We went and bought food. We went and cooked breakfast for each other. We really immersed ourselves in, okay, this is the marketplace. We're going to stay out of the hotels now. We go get Airbnbs.
Yeah,
So we really changed that mentality of, let's just hit abandoned places, to let's go learn everything that this place has to offer.
I think it became more about community than just buildings. Mm-hmm.
So who would you reach out to at first? So did you have somebody who you had already set up contact with, and you did your research? But when you head to these cities, is somebody there saying hello?
It depends on the city. So some cities we just went out and did our thing. Other places like New Orleans, I remember Lori reached out to their Preservation Society, just asking those guys for assistance, because not financial, but more so of a guidance. Because when we went down there after, this was probably 10 years after Katrina, We have a mindset on what New Orleans is going to look like, and it was absolutely amazing. It didn't look anything like what we thought. And I remember Lori reaching out to their society before we even took that trip. Lori didn't make the trip, but she talked to them, just asking them their process. You know, how did they bounce back? You know, what were some avenues that we can take, you know, on our end? And they were very receptive and, you know, talking with us. There are other, we get the most support from photographers, believe it or not. Mm-hmm. People who follow us on Instagram, when we see that we're going to their city and we already been talking for months, it's a lot easier to reach out to those individuals and say, hey, I'm coming into town. Are you free? If you're not free, do you have any suggestions? So social media is really our biggest, I guess, impactful place where we can just reach out to people almost automatically and just get some guidance on local places to visit, hidden places to visit, you know, what's the best food that's around to get that true experience when we go visit.
Right.
How many people are involved in the DK Devils?
Currently 14. The number fluctuates up and down over the years. I want to say the biggest hitter for us is we started being creatives and just loving to travel. As we did the transition to be a nonprofit, some of the people who were on board specifically to go travel, they were not on board for this nonprofit. Ended up losing some individuals.
The nonprofit was more like work, you know, and building something opposed to just having fun. Taking pictures and traveling is fun.
Nonprofit is work.
Yeah, it's work.
It's a lot of work.
Is there a membership? Like, if people want to join the DK Devils, do you have like a membership fee?
Like the base level membership is $60.
That's a year, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You get a t-shirt and you get like first dib invites on trips and we call them team building events, our team building days. And the membership levels, there's a whole tier system online, but the base level, that's what it gets you. It gets you a shirt and just gets you into like some behind the scenes stuff. And when we decide we want to go get dirty again, you get those special invites as a group member.
So how is the pandemic affecting DK Devils and you personally within that?
Well, it pretty much canceled everything in the beginning of the year and mid-year. I think our first official event might have been August when we had some artists come out and paint at Union Station. So we had a
placemaking. So we had an event called the Rust Belt Takeover.
There you go, Rust Belt Takeover.
And this was in partnership with Young Preservation Coalition. Their name is super long. Rust Belt Coalition of Young Preservationists. They're based out of Ohio. Their president is Sarah Marson. She has been a very, very, very good friend to us in our journey as a nonprofit. So we were going to have over 200 individuals come to Gary and essentially be DK Devils for a weekend.
From all over, like other states, they come and this would, I don't know how many years she's been doing it, but I think she...
This would have been the fourth year.
So these were people that have already been on her trips. But what was so cool about it is they get to experience Gary and we got to set up what they experience. And when I tell you, like, there was like the Chernobyl, we went to Chernobyl in 2019. When I tell you, like, me and Tyrell were on eBay trying to buy all this stuff from like the 80s and like from Ukraine, that was like my favorite part because we were going to showcase all these items and the pictures that we took at Chernobyl. And when it canceled, I mean, look, my heart was broken. I was like, no, I was really sad about that. But it was much more than just that. But that was my favorite part.
And the Chernobyl experience for us was great in comparison to our city because we had a certain expectation level when we got there.
Yeah.
Our expectation was we're going to see a bunch of hole in the grounds and it's going to be completely run down. And it was everything but. And so that was going to be that was like the opening event for that Rust Belt. Hey, this is our Chernobyl event. We have our version of the Ukraine of food, the food from Ukraine. You're going to be able to immerse yourself in the culture and our pictures. We have music from Ukraine.
Yeah.
And we want to kind of showcase, this is what you think's going on over there. This is what actually is going on over there. And the same way that you hear negative comments about Gary, Indiana, these are the positive people who are putting things in place in this city to, you know, turn things around.
Yeah, it would mirror.
And it was the perfect, in my mind, the perfect, you know, launch event for that tour that we had to cancel. And that was going to be sponsored 100% by Indiana Landmarks. Sarah, she made some phone calls. She got the whole event financed. I'm like, man, I love you.
Yes.
So that cut down on the, everyone had to pay a fee to attend, but
I mean, think we were going to put it, it was between $30 and $50. We had some, you know,
but it had to be a lot higher, but she, by her getting it financed, completely cut down on the reservation cost. So it was like, man, you get food for 3 days.
Yeah.
3 days of events and you have to pay $20-$30. You can't beat that.
Yeah. So that was one of the biggest, the Rust Belt Tour was one of the biggest events that was canceled from Corona. And then
we canceled Love Fest too.
Oh gosh, Love Fest. I forgot about that. That was supposed to be in August, this past August. So that didn't happen. And then we also had to postpone our Capital Campaign launch. I mean, we just launched that, so that's still okay. But it, I feel like when like this pandemic happened, it's kind of awkward to say, hey, support us, even though everyone's losing their jobs and you have to work around the whole fundraising and campaigning thing. But that was tough.
Well, we just have about a few seconds left. First of all, real briefly, what are you looking forward to after the pandemic? And then give us your website, Facebook, and how to get a hold of you guys.
Across the board, everything is Decay Devils. So website is decaydevils.org, Decay Devils on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Moving forward, we're pushing our capital campaign throughout the course of next year, and that's decaydevils.org/unionstation. You get to see our vision, what we anticipate the building to be. The big hitter for us is just stressing the point that we're not just preserving a building. Everything that we do is for the community, is for the people, and that's our vision. This building has brought so many people together for so many different walks of life, so many different backgrounds. We want to continue to push that forward.
Very good. Well, we appreciate you coming on Art in the Air. We've been talking to the DK Devils, President Tyrell Anderson and Vice President Lori Gonzalez. We appreciate you coming on the show and sharing with us about the DK Devils and their mission.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, guys.
You've been listening to Art in the Air, and we'd like to thank our guests this week. Art in the Air is heard every Friday at 11 a.m. and rebroadcast Monday at 5 p.m. on WVLP and Sunday at 7 p.m. on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. Thanks again to Greg Kovach, WVLP Station Manager, and Tom Maloney, Vice President of Radio Operations for Lakeshore Public Radio. Underwriters for Art in the Air are Valparaiso University's Brower Museum, our landlord, Walt Breidinger of Paragon Investments, and Mary LeVan, Arts Patron. Art in the Air is supported by an Indiana Arts Commission Arts Project Grant and the National Endowment for the Arts. If you're interested in being a guest or sending us information about your arts, arts-related event, or exhibit, please email us at aota@breck.com. That's aota@breck.com, or contact us through our Facebook page. Your hosts were Larry Breckner and Esther Golden, and we invite you back next week for another episode of Art on the Air.
Aloha, everyone. Have a splendid week.
Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. Express yourself through art and show the world your heart. You're in the know with Esther and Larry. Art on the Air today. Stay in the know with Larry and Esther. Art on the Air our way. Express yourself through art and show the world.